Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Robert Atkinson, founding president, ITIF, an internationally acclaimed leader in technology innovation and policy. Rob, you have a most amazing background. You've done it all in many respects. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep work experiences with our audience.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Now, Rob, again, because of your background and because of all your work in policy and driving innovation, I'd like to kind of get some ideas or some of your recommendations. So for in this next question, it's about driving innovation, ICT capacity building for any country internationally. What are your specific ICT investment recommendations, and these recommendations coming from, let's say, for government, for industry, investors, venture capital, the general public, education and research?
Yeah, it's hard to answer that in a specific way because each country obviously differs in terms of where they're at kind of the basic level. What you need is a strong ICT infrastructure, and that involves both at the network and the user. So countries that that have a robust wired broadband network, ideally with a fair amount of fiber in it or coax cable that could be expanded. That's a pretty central infrastructure for moving forward in the digital economy. If you don't have that, it's hard to move forward. And at the same time, a lot of spectrum freed up for commercial use, particularly into the 4G LTE bands. Countries that have that in place should be in better position to drive all the new wireless apps in the wireless ecosystem. At the same time, though, if your enterprises and your citizens or consumers don't have ICT capabilities or their ICT capabilities are weak, it's going to be hard to build business models on top of that. So a good example is the United States, where we actually have pretty good broadband. The reason we don't have as high take-up rates as many other countries do is we have a large share of citizens, almost a third, without a computer at home. And you compare that to a country like Korea, where they've had very aggressive efforts to get close to universal computer ownership and digital literacy with their citizens, and that does make a difference.
So do you have any recommendations then again for innovation and ICT capacity building from, let's say, if there's angel investors out there, maybe things they should be looking at or venture capital?
Yeah, it's, I think one of the interesting things that's happening in the ICT industry, at least from talking to venture fund colleagues of mine, is that it's getting a lot easier to build an ICT business, particularly one that's not a hardware business, an app business or a software business, in part because it's just so much cheaper to get to assemble what's needed. You can go out to cloud services and get the storage and processing you need. You can get the coding and a lot of the software work done around the world for low costs. It's almost like just figuring out the right business model innovation, and app innovation is really the most important thing, and then just being able to organize the execution of that. So in some ways, I think this is an industry that's different than what it was 10 years ago, where there were probably going to be fewer VC opportunities in it, just because a lot of innovators, a lot of startups don't need as much VC money as they might have needed. But I think areas where that there's going to be there's going to be opportunities, again, that differs by country. But if you look at the most like the U.S. is clearly one of the most advanced. You see that there are lots and lots of opportunities for business applications that make different kinds of business functions work effectively and efficiently. A lot of the attention is focused really, including in the U.S. and in Silicon Valley, on social networking and almost entertainment-like applications, games for the cell phone and things like that. And, those are, they may be good investment opportunities. I'm sure they are if you just, the latest acquisition by Facebook of that photo sharing company, is an enormous amount of money for, 12 people who are working there. I'm sure there's value there. But I think there's a risk of looking at those as saying those are really the major drivers. Let's get the next YouTube or the next Facebook. And in fact, I think there's an awful lot of B2B and enterprise type of applications that will play important roles.
And then again, for this last two questions, and they're sort of related to the same area again, driving innovation, ICT capacity building for basically as general recommendations for countries internationally. If you had investment dollars then on the education side, where would you put it? That is in education and research.
Well, again, it depends on what I want to do. If I want to drive an effective ICT industry, the most important place I would put them is in developing more and almost as importantly, if not more importantly, better computer science graduates, computer science professionals. If you look in the United States, the last, I guess 2 years ago, the last data that were available, there were three times as many high school seniors who took the advanced placement test in art history as there were in computer science. And that's a pretty sad state of affairs when more people are studying something that really has not a lot of real value to society, certainly not as much, anywhere near as much as computer science does. And I think what countries need to be able to do is to reorganize their education systems. So for example, in the U.S., in most high schools, in most states, computer science does not qualify as a math course or something. So you have to take 4 years of math, but if you take computer science, it doesn't qualify for that. So it becomes an elective that very few people take. And even at the college level, there are a lot of things that we could be doing to get more young people involved in computer science. So that would be that I think would be really one of the main areas. And then, as I said earlier, I think that there's an awful lot governments can do to encourage citizens, just general populace in particular, to adopt computers and digital literacy. And again, speaking in the from the U.S. perspective, there's a new partnership that our Federal Communications Commission has undertaken with a number of companies, particularly in the cable television and cable modem industry, cable broadband industry, to get low-income households to buy computers, to learn how to use them, to become more digitally literate. So I think those are important steps as well.
Now, Robert, do you have the sort of your pulse on the world and also on sort of the best models that are out there? And in fact, I looked at your Global Policy Index report, so, and you have some examples in there. But so this question is related to that, but it's related to the series of questions I just asked. And this is about what are the best models and resource links to drive innovation and ICT capacity building for countries to emulate? And these models or resources are coming from, let's say, government or industry, investors, venture capital, the general public, and education and research.
You know, I think at one level, the best model is to have a favorable attitude towards what could be termed creative destruction. So there is this famous phrase by the economist Joseph Schumpeter, talks about that capitalist economies are based upon and growth is based upon what he calls creative destruction. In other words, the emergence of new business models, new industries that replace old business models and old industries. And that really is a lot of what the ICT revolution is about. It's about figuring out a way to do something that historically other businesses have done or other business models have done it and then disrupt it. So we saw that, for example, with the way the newspaper industry has been disrupted here as they've lost ads to things like Craigslist. We've seen it the way the circuit switch telephony industry has been disrupted as people have switched to VoIP or cellular networks. We've seen it with how the travel agent industry has been disrupted as people book online now with that. And it's surprising how many countries, though, want to resist that and feel that that somehow is a problem and there should be roadblocks or barriers put in place. Some European countries, for example, had a law that you couldn't discount books. If you were selling books, you couldn't sell them at a discount. And the reason for that was they didn't want to disrupt their bricks and mortar bookstore industry. So if you do that, that's sending a pretty strong signal to entrepreneurs that it could be more risky to build a new and innovative business model if you're going to get a lot of resistance from it. So that's, I think, one important thing to do. I think other things are making sure that you don't overly tax these new business models. In the U.S., for example, the states tax wireless broadband services and wireless service in general approximately three times more than they just tax the sale of a pair of shoes. And again, you don't want to have those kinds of barriers, those kinds of regulations. Another really, I think, important one is on the regulatory front. If you compare Europe versus the United States, one of the really interesting questions is, why is the United States so much further further in the lead on internet industries, internet firms. Europeans really don't have as many internet firms, and certainly not the globally successful brands the way the United States does. Part of that is because we have scale, so firms can scale in a big market like the U.S. and other English language countries. But another part of it is the fact that the European privacy rules have been structured in such a way to make it much harder for European internet entrepreneurs to monetize eyeballs. In the U.S., it's easier to monetize eyeballs and get more money from web users if you have some sense of that the person on the site is likely to be interested in something else through what's called behavioral targeting. So you don't need to know the person's name or address or anything like that. You just need to know that this web user is probably going to be a male who is showing some interest in cars. So then you throw up an ad for a sports car on the website and you can make more money. Well, the European Privacy Directive makes that a lot more difficult. Because of their concerns about privacy and their focus on regulation. And that's just going to make it harder for a company to get the revenue they need to build up a vibrant vibrant firm.
You know, you talk about policy and regulation, then do you have a sense of, you know, you mentioned the U.S., other countries that you would say, you know, let's say there's a developing country and they want to look to some other country to model. The U.S. could be one. Are there others that they should model?
Yeah, so I think one of the problems, the U.S. tends to do very well at internet and IT innovations where one firm can figure out the solution, get it out in the marketplace, and take advantage of that. Where we tend to do not as well are innovations that require, if you will, collective action or that are part of an overall system. So a really good example of that is health IT. A few years ago in the U.S., both Google and Microsoft put in place health IT applications marketed directly to consumers to get them to use to build these health vaults. And one of them, I'm blanking whether it's Google or Microsoft, one of them had just recently announced that they were abandoning that. The other one is still struggling. And the reason for that was because Google and Microsoft don't control much of the ecosystem. if you can't get your health record in original digital form, you're not going to be able to put it onto the Google or Microsoft vault. And if the doctors aren't doing that, and if the testing labs aren't doing that in the hospitals and the like. Whereas you look at a country like Sweden or Denmark, Finland, or the Netherlands, where they have very, very high rates of IT, health IT adoption, both on the enterprise side, doctors' offices, hospitals, and also as patients or individuals with their own health data vaults, if you will. That was done, they were able to do that because the government helped coordinate that ecosystem. It got everybody to act together. They got common standards, et cetera, et cetera. The U.S. hasn't been able to do that as much. So I think that's a big area where government can play an important role. Another good example is the country of Estonia, where they have a digital czar, and the digital czar, or whatever the position is, thinks about these strategic chicken or egg system questions. And one of the things that Estonia was able to do is they're one of the world leaders now in what are called digital signatures. So this is something that would be wonderful for everybody to have. In other words, your own digital signature, so you can authenticate yourself online. You can sign a document, a legal document that's legally binding online. You don't have to get a fax copy of it and sign your, you know, put your signature on it and fax it back to somebody. Well, the Estonians were able to do that because they put in place a national program to help get everybody a digital signature. And some very large percentage of the adult population now has one of these things. So there are things like that where sort of smart government, public-private partnerships in these collective action areas, I think, can play a really big role. A lot of countries are doing things like that. Malaysia's got a very interesting program like that, and many other countries.
Now, if we would extend that question into the education and research, the U.S. does lead, but are there other countries who are doing a fine job? Maybe I should backtrack here. I know that the U.S. is maybe ranked, 25th in math, and sort of in the high school level, something like that. But if we were to kind of expand that question into universities and colleges, together with the K-12 system, are there other countries that you think are sort of really good models that we should be emulating worldwide?
Well, I think the U.S. Has essentially a system that has, it's a pretty bifurcated system. So we've got to get some excellence and then some real parts of the system that just are performing incredibly poorly. And we see that including in higher education, where there are a lot of a lot of colleges and universities that are frankly not doing a very good job of educating kids, and then you've got some world-class ones that everybody obviously always talks about. You know, education is one of those strange things. I'm not sure where anybody's, you know, really doing it right. One of the problems you have in Asia is that they get high scores usually, but oftentimes it's just through sort of brute force rote memorization. So, you know, they really, really work kids hard in Korea. The parents are you know, super, super focused on getting their kids a good education, and there's an incredible amount of pressure, and they really do well on math. But the real question, I think, is can they take that and then combine it with, you know, real innovation? And I think that's the real secret sauce, if you can do that. So we have got some places that do that quite well. A place that we really, really love is a place called Olin College, O-L-I-N, funded originally by the Olin Foundation up outside of Boston. And Olin is a little college of about 400 students, I believe. It's only engineering students. That's all they teach there is engineering. But they combine engineering with business and with design. And so kids from the very day they get there, they're learning engineering in a very multifaceted way, really all around how do you build, how do you not only engineer something, but bring it to the market and meet consumer needs or you know user needs. And that's a whole new model of how to teach engineering. So I think there are some really interesting models like that. There's another really interesting model in the U.S. There's a little high school, a charter high school in Minnesota called, I think it's Minnesota Country Day. I'm not going to get it exactly right. But it's a very interesting high school where there are no courses. It's all 100% project-based learning. And kids can focus on, they work collectively in projects. They all have laptops. They have mentors who we would call teachers, but they're their guides or facilitators or mentors. And that's a pretty, you know, radical rethink of how we do college, high school education. And I think it's one of the things a lot of people have missed is there's been a lot of literature in the private sector about how IT enables and not only enables but requires re-engineering of business processes. It's not just enough to take the existing business processes and digitize them. It's the fact that IT enables you to do business processes in fundamentally new ways. That insight really has not been reflected at the high school or college level very much. And so this is a school that basically says that is you don't need teachers teaching your rote facts. You've got, you know, Google and the internet to figure out rote facts. What you need teachers do is help you think how to be part of a group, how to do research projects, etc. So there are some interesting things like that. You know, just one last quick thing. I think one of the biggest transformations in higher education is will be a thing called MOOCs, massively operated online courses, whatever. And the idea there, this is what Stanford has done recently. They just taught a MOOC on software programming, and I think it was like 10,000 students or something like that. We just did an event on higher ed and IT recently, and there's some fascinating examples of this where you could have thousands and tens of thousands of students taking the same course, if you will, online and having all these great tools for learning assessments. So I think we're really at the cusp of innovation in education as it's enabled by IT.
So I'm going to get into more detail on these sort of on the education side and the best models a little bit later. But before that, I just want to ask some additional questions here, and that is, what are the top ICT challenges for, one, government, two, industry, three, academia, and four, media?
Well, I think for industry, the top challenge is it's essentially what Eric Brynjolfsson at MIT has articulated in his excellent work. And Eric is a professor in the Sloan Business School there, who's really one of the leading thinkers around ICT and business. And what Eric has found is that the companies that have the highest profitability and effectiveness and even productivity are ones that use a lot of IT. So they have a lot of hardware, a lot of software, a lot of embedded systems, and at the same time, they're what he calls strong on being a digital organization. And that means things like you've transformed moving all your analog physical paper processes into digital ones. You empower frontline workers, and a number of other sort of steps that Eric has identified in these leading edge organizations. And it turns out that when you just do one of those two things, you can be a digital organization without losing a lot of IT, or you can use a lot of IT and not be a digital organization. And if you do one of those but not both, you do okay, you do better than if you do none of them. But there's something in the kind of an exponential combination, if you will. When you put the two together, you get more than an additive result in terms of performance outcomes. So I think that's really the case for a lot of firms and a lot of industries. I mean, there are industries that have essentially not really used IT to its full extent, and I think that's really the opportunity there, is to figure out how to do that. When it comes to government, again, government really has two challenges or two imperatives for IT. One is to use IT in government itself, and countries have made progress. You look at a country like Singapore, for example, which is usually up there in the top of being the world leader, really, really pushing this through their government agencies. The U.S. has made mixed progress. Canada generally tends to do well. Sweden has done well. But overall, governments really have not taken the transformative power of IT to heart. A lot of government websites are, not very useful, not very user-friendly. There's still an awful lot of paper forms or PDF forms. Print this form out in a PDF, and it's like, just even doing simple things like moving to e-forms, a lot of governments haven't embraced that. Partly that's due to a lack of imagination. Partly it's due to resistance from government workers. Partly it's due to inability to get the capital up front to save the money later. But I think that's one of the challenges government has. The other challenge for government is to put in place the policy environment to drive overall societal digital transformation in the private sector and the nonprofit sector as well. And then there, that involves a wide variety of things, which we've touched on: taxes, regulation, investment, education, and the like. What were your other categories? Were media, is that what you said? And
yeah, the other two categories would be media and academia.
Well, in media, I think that's a much harder one, because certainly what we're seeing is the disintermediation of many media intermediaries. It's really not clear whether we'll have television networks or certainly local affiliates in 20 years. You think about, why do we have local television affiliates? There's really only one reason, and that's because TV broadcast signals could only go 20 or 30 or 40 miles around in a circle, so you had these towers and then you had a little television station around them or at the core of them. That doesn't make any technological sense anymore. People will increasingly get their media not through over the air. Very few Americans, for example, use over the air now. They'll get it on either sort of a dedicated stream like cable TV, or just through internet access, just going to a website and getting it. So I think in that sense, I don't think there's a lot. Radio stations are in a somewhat similar position as well. So I think for them, it's just really a question of how do you downsize, or how do you sort of slow down the erosion of that market. I don't think there's anything they can do to really change that. It's the content developers, I think, that are in the more interesting situation. The people who are making TV shows or making movies or making music or other kinds of content, and then that gets distributed in a variety of ways. I think the number one challenge for them is piracy. And the real question is whether societies are going to be willing to bite the bullet and put in place policies that effectively address piracy. You're never going to eliminate piracy, but you can reduce it significantly. You can make it so that the person who might want to just pirate as opposed to pay, that on the margin they'll end up switching to paying, and they'll have a few hardcore pirates who'll continue to do their thing. But you want to make it harder for those people to steal, and at the same time make it easier for them to buy legally. And that's going to require government to empower more piracy, anti-piracy efforts. With regard to education, again, I think education, really the main thing there is really opening up to new business models. I mean, the idea that college is going to be this thing where you have a person stand in front of, 20 to 300 people talking for 90 minutes, that's just not going to be the model going forward. That's not to say that there won't be some of that. I think there will always be a role for that, but it'll be a much smaller role. So you'll have ultimately what we have to get to in higher ed, I believe, is a kind of federated system where you can cobble together a wide array of courses or capabilities, some of them gotten in person, some of them online, some of them various ways, and then have somebody accredit that as saying you have the capability or you have the prowess to now have a degree in such and such. The problem is that universities now are taking two roles and combining them, which I think is a mistake. And they do it because it keeps their vested interest and power. But they're an education provider and an education accreditor. And I think those two roles have to get separated out if we're going to get real innovation.
So I'm going to switch gears a bit now in terms of specific examples that could be modeled for success. And you've somewhat covered this already, but my first question, and there's going to be a series of questions, but my first question is going to drill down in the education area, and that is, what are your recommendations and best models for the ICT education system that is K-12 and university? And you've already mentioned Olin College and the Minnesota County Day program and the MOOCs program. Are there any others that you want to add to that?
Well, I think I think in terms of the development of the programs that are really focused on getting people really high skills, there are a couple. I mean, because I think it's important to realize that while ICT is a critical driver of growth, not that many people actually are computer scientists or computer engineers or even programmers. You know, most people are users of ICT. They might play around with designing a website or something. They're managing web content or something. But the real part of the ICT economy that drives the innovation and the productivity is a small, relatively small share of the population, maybe 2 to 3% of the workforce. So it's not like every kid going through school has to learn how Haskell programming or something like that. But what we do need is we need enough of them to know that, and they need to be really, really good. So if you look at a place like Carnegie Mellon, which is a very, very good school when it comes to computer science education, I think Carnegie is a model. They've made a number of changes over the recent years, and one of the interesting changes they made was, for a while there, females were increasing in terms of their going into CS, and then they started female rate going into CS went down, and the male rate went up. And so Carnegie Mellon looked at that, and what they realized was that the way they just accepted students was sort of giving females a discriminatory harder time. So they changed the way they accepted students, not at all to lower their standards, but to change what they were looking for. And they ended up getting a much higher rate of female acceptance into CS. And with no effect on quality, the females were doing just as well as the males, if not better, but certainly not worse. But they're the exception, frankly. I mean, there may be a few places that have been trying to do things like that. So I think doing a much better job of figuring out how to get more people into CS and get them to be excited and stay, I think that's an important step. In terms of models around the world, I'm not really sure. I think one of the really important things government needs to do is adequately fund computer science research. In the U.S., we haven't done a very good job on that. In fact, if you look at overall R&D on computer science or IT, the U.S. actually lags behind many other countries. You look at the Scandinavian countries, and as a share of their economy, they're investing much more than we are in these areas. I think it could be a problem for the U.S. going forward. You know, one other thing I'll just say on the high school level, I think the single best thing we could do, or think single best thing any country could do, would be to look seriously at the establishment of math and science academies or specialty math and science high schools. So in the U.S., we have a few of these high schools around the country, the Bronx Academy, which has been in existence for a long, long time, but schools like the North Carolina Math and Science Academy or the Illinois Math and Science Academy, the Arkansas Math and Science Academy, these are really, really wonderful schools that they just give kids who are interested in computer science and other kinds of sciences and engineering, they give them an enormous immersed and in-depth environment environment in which to study this stuff and, you know, really love it and get excited about it and get passionate about it, follow their passions, do high quality work. Very, very different than that kind of typical high school where, in most high schools, again, at least in the United States where I'm familiar with it, we don't really teach computer science. We teach, you know, glorified JavaScript programming, usually by, faculty who are just kind of not really teaching the science behind it. They're just, it's almost like it's a craft rather than a science. In other words, they're just learning rote craft things to do as programmers. And, you know, that really is not going to cut it. If you want to really make this work right, you got to get kids who understand the underlying theory and science of what computer science is all about so that they can use that as the foundation. And by and large, we don't teach that in high school in the United States.
Now let's extend this question now into what are your recommendations and best models for technology parks and economic zones?
It's certainly easier to answer that maybe in the negative. I think there are places that have adopted technology parks or zones with almost Research Triangle Park seems to be successful, so we'll do something like that, and we'll create some real estate, and we'll put some incentives in place to get companies to locate there and all. It depends on what it is that a country or a region wants to do. If really all you want or all they want is to, you know, find a place where they can attract some corporate CS activity or IT activity and provide some incentives and a nice campus with a lake and, you know, a pretty jogging path, you know, that's essentially a real estate play and may work, it may not work. But I think the more interesting and effective ones are ones where you're trying to create a real innovation ecosystem, and ideally doing that around a university that has real capabilities. Again, I would point to Carnegie Mellon as sort of one interesting example. They've created a program there of what they call lablets, LEABLETS. And what they are very small labs right on campus. So the building is, you know, I don't know, within, I'm going to say 500 feet of the computer science building. It seems like that when I visited it. And they have Intel is there and Google is there. I believe Microsoft is there, a number of companies. And it's really a very interesting environment where the companies get to interact with faculty and the students. The students get to come over and hang out and do internships or real work at the companies and get a sense of what real world problems are. And so you've created this really rich interchange, and not kind of just the sterile real estate model where you get a bunch of companies that don't talk to one another. I think that's the more interesting and useful model. You're also seeing a model where some places, like Michigan have hired venture capitalists, or it's not hired, excuse me, allowed venture capitalists to actually set up shop right there on the campus and find deals and get a way to really commercialize them. But, you know, all at the end of the day, if you don't have really, really good quality and well-funded research going on at these places, that's kind of the basic thing you have to have. You can't take a shortcut to that.
What are your recommendations and best models for ICT innovation programs? And they could be industry-based or government-based and so on, and ICT infrastructure.
Well, I think, again, you have to kind of look at the various levels of that. So if we're looking at it purely from a broadband infrastructure level, and the sort of level one, if you will, the best models there, I believe, are ones where you're freeing up a lot of spectrum, particularly the good spectrum in the lower ranges that where you have high bandwidth propagation characteristics. And you're getting a lot of that spectrum into the commercial marketplace, and then you're letting that be allocated in a market-based way. So commercial auctions and secondary markets, reselling, and I think that's a very, very important thing to do, particularly getting spectrum now for LTE, because if countries aren't really advanced on 4G LTE, they're going to fall behind some point soon. Some point we'll get to 5G LTE Plus. And that, you know, again, there'll be, you know, a lot of innovation still to happen in wireless. We're nowhere near maturation on that. So countries have to be able to enable their system to be on the cutting edge of that. When it comes to broadband, it's a little more complicated because countries really have different underlying broadband systems. So you look at the three countries in the world that have the most intermodal competition, in other words, two pipes to the home. That's Canada, United States, and Korea. really almost as a history of an accident of history, the way our regulations were, the way things evolved. Both countries have high levels of cable modem service and high levels of broadband over telephone lines, either partly copper and then fiber, or all fiber in the case of some places with phone companies like Verizon. Now you compare that to a place like Germany or France or some of these other countries where they historically never really developed a vibrant cable TV industry, and so they're really stuck with broadband over telephony. And they're in a little bit more difficult shape. In the U.S. and Canada and Korea, we are able to essentially, you know, much more effectively deregulate and rely on intermodal competition. They are much more, they've been forced to go and regulate and open up the pipe, the copper wire to intermodal competition to get competitors on the pipe as opposed to competitors between the pipes. You know, I think the biggest mistake countries make is thinking that there's one model, to follow when it comes to wired broadband. You just have to kind of realize where you are. But I think really, sort of rising above all that, I think one of the things that countries need is they need a real strategy. And a lot of countries, you look at a country like Japan, for example, where they started with a strategy in the early 2000s, E-Japan won. And E-Japan won was largely a, not exclusively, but it was largely a broadband pipe strategy. It was to build the best pipes in the world. And they really do have a great broadband system in Japan, 100 meg, I believe, 90% of the homes in Japan. I mean, it's a phenomenal system. Now, it's a little easier in Japan to do that because you have fairly high densely populated areas. You don't have the kind of suburban developments that the U.S. and Canada have. But still, certainly some of the policies they've had, allowing companies to write off equipment investments very early on, that certainly helped, and others. But what Japan evolved to very quickly is they realized that having just the sort of level one broadband pipe was not enough, that you needed much more than that. And so they've developed E-Japan 2, and then it was U-Japan. I think that's the latest one, Ubiquitous Japan, where they're talking about sensor networks, they're talking about wireless applications, e-government, a whole set of other things. But it's what I find very interesting about Japan and Korea and some other countries that have very good broadband strategies. Many of them end up having very poor enterprise adoption. U.S. is actually just the opposite. We have a broadband strategy, very well articulated, very good analysis that was done a couple of years ago, by Chairman Janikowski at our Federal Communications Commission. It hasn't really been as fully implemented as it could be, in part because it requires congressional approval and funding for certain things. But it was very good strategy. But as I said, it hasn't really been implemented as much as other countries have. But what the United States has, much, much better than a lot of the other countries, is our enterprises adopt IT much more. They're more, if you go back to the Brynjolfsson work, they're farther down on the digital enterprise and they're farther over on the overall IT. And you compare that to the Japanese, where a lot of their enterprises still use custom-made software. They don't take advantage of it. That's one of the reasons why they don't take advantage of off-the-shelf systems. That's one of the reasons why they're so interested in moving to the cloud. But I think that's a real challenge that all countries have got to really look head on at, is what are your major enterprises doing with regard to IT, and why are they not adopting more if they aren't? And then what are the kinds of levers, if any, that governments can have to put in place to move them in that direction? Because that's where the biggest bang for the buck is going to be. If your retail sector and your banking sector, your manufacturing sector, et cetera, are all big users of ICT, getting big productivity gains from it, you'll go a long, long way.
I think you've answered this question already, and that is, what are your best recommendations and best models for R&D laboratories, and that is partnering universities with government and industry? And you talk about Carnegie Mellon, but do you have others?
Well, I think another really good example is the University of Washington. Their computer science department is, in some ways it's not a surprise that they're so good because Microsoft is there, and it's not because Microsoft, I believe, has funded them, but it's not so much that, it's that the state has figured out that They have a real innovation cluster, if you will, in the Seattle area around software and ICT, and therefore they better have a really good computer science department, and they do. But you know, that department there works very, very closely with they do some really great research projects that are related to industry. You know, I think that's really one of the big challenges a lot of countries have, particularly European countries and some Asian countries, where they haven't been able to crack the code on how do you get real industry university partnerships. And I think, you know, a good model to me is what the Swedes are doing now. I think the Swedes are trying to crack that code. One of the things Sweden does is it basically allocates money for its engineering and science programs at universities in part on the basis of how much industry matching money you've gotten. So if you're getting more money from industry, the government will give you more money. And that is a very strong incentive for universities to go out and really become relevant and figure out how to, you know, reduce a lot of the roadblocks and the bureaucratic barriers to working more closely with industry. And that doesn't mean that university CS departments should become, you know, very much applied research labs just doing, you know, coding. but it does mean that they can do a lot better job of working on problems that are going to be more relevance to industry, even if they're kind of, you know, if you will, kind of basic science, computer science problems. And you have some places in the U.S., Stanford, Caltech, certainly the MIT, Washington, Carnegie Mellon, that I think do a pretty good job of that.
What are your recommendations of best models for public institutes or other kinds of institutes for supporting ICP companies?
I mean, some countries have these broader institutes, like Taiwan has ETRI, for example, which is a big, giant, almost, you know, commercially relevant national laboratory. And I think that's ETRI, as far as I know, from what I see, seems like a very, very effective enterprise. I think, though, a lot of countries may not be able to develop institutions at that scale or that size. I think an interesting model to me is what the Finns do with regard to their program called TEKES, T-E-K-E-S, which is a very, very well-funded model, and it's a very kind of almost, it's very industry-friendly, lean, non-bureaucratic organization that works quite closely with academics and industry. And they've developed a number of target areas. I believe wireless is one of them. And they've developed these target areas where they work quite closely with industry and universities to build up these ecosystems and these relationships. And so I think that's a very good model. I think the real key thing, if you want to move towards the institute role, is that the institutions have to be, institutes really have to be, have real benchmarks of performance and accountability. Are they providing real value to the economy? Are they transferring information and knowledge and technology to industry? Are they spinning off new companies and startups? I mean, those are the things you're wanting to get from an institute like that.
Again, what are your best recommendations and models for ICT innovation incubation accelerator centers?
I'm not as much of an expert there. I do think that there's some very interesting models coming out of Silicon Valley on that. I mean, Silicon Valley historically has just done that almost naturally. It's not naturally, it's actually a lot of work behind it. But there's some new models there where they bring people in, particularly younger people, give them small amounts of seed money for very, very quick proof of concept ideas. There's an idea that one of the chief innovation guys at Google has. I'm blanking on his name. He's an Italian American. I guess he's Italian, but he's here. I was on a panel with him about a year ago, and he has this very, very cool idea that he's calling. He has a little booklet, which I guess if you were to Google it, you could find it, called pretotyping. So not prototyping, but preto, like pre, where you're basically encouraged to develop ideas very, very quickly and test them out before you put a lot of money into them and a lot of time and effort and find out then and only then that they may or may not work. And that seems to be a model that some places are using to get a lot of ideas in, test them very quickly, and then if they work, to kind of, again, you know, help the folks to kind of with the next levels.
What are your recommendations again in models for having sort of associations coming together where there could be vendors and customers and maybe researchers or whatever being part of these associations? Do you have any examples?
There are certainly some examples like that. There's a group in Silicon Valley that's focusing on services innovation. And they're bringing together a lot of the big IT, a lot of the traditional IT companies to figure out kind of cooperative ways that you would drive ICT services innovation. And I think that's a very good model because I think a lot of the big ICT challenges that we face going forward are not challenges that an individual firm can face, can address on their own. They can't just throw a bunch of coders together and come up with a new device or a new app or something like that and throw it on the marketplace. And, you know, a good example of that is the smart grid. Maybe somebody can come up with, certainly companies have come up with good technology to make the electric grid smarter, but it's not just like going and putting that in place. You need to have, you need to have the software there. You need the meters to be smart. You need the regulations and the way utilities charge money to change. You need a system so that the appliances and other kinds of things that might be able to utilize the smart grid are integrated into that so that your refrigerator becomes smart, your washing machine becomes smart. You want to have pricing policies that interact with that. You want to have data policies so that the individual has access to their data and could use it and provide it to any application provider they want. That's a lot more than any one individual firm can do. And so that's why I think it's important that there be these cross-industry collaborations that address essentially these system-wide challenges. You know, another one that's certainly evolving very, very quickly in the U.S., although I'm not sure if it's going to evolve in the right direction. I think that remains to be seen, but that's mobile wallets. So the ability to use your phone as a payment device, or even more than just a payment device, as an identity device and a ticket device, and all these other things. So, for example, in Japan and Korea, you could use your cell phone to download a movie ticket, pay for it, and walk into the movie theater and just wave your phone over the turnstile and walk in. You don't need a paper ticket or a paper form or anything like that. This is a pretty platform-like technology, because if you can get these things in place, then the amount of apps that can emerge out of this are really, really phenomenal. But you're not going to build an app if you don't have a lot of the share of the market having one of these devices, and you're not going to get a device until you have a lot of apps and a lot of places where they have these readers to read the data on the phone. So again, building up a robust mobile wallet kind of mobile payment ecosystem is something that's very, very hard for any one company to do, and that's where these collaborative efforts, I think, can play such an important role.
What are your best models for seed funding programs, where maybe there's some joint private-public partnerships for startups, or venture funding programs, again, joint private-public collaborations or entrepreneurship program?
I don't have a lot of good examples on that one. I think as a generalized set of principles, I think what government needs to do on that is to figure out if there are market failures or market gaps, and then seek to fill those. And there may not be. It depends upon what country you're in, what region of a country you're in. I think one mistake some countries and some regions make is they have a sort of build it and they will come approach to it, that if it's, oh, well, we don't have enough VC deals, we don't have enough startups, ICT startups will provide money. And it may be that the reason you don't have enough startups is because you don't have enough startups, you don't have enough demand, you don't have enough deal flow, you don't have enough stuff coming into the pipeline that's actually demanding capital. So you can't sort of just assume that it's on the capital side. The supply side could be on the demand side as well. So that's why I think the best models are ones that look holistically at the entire ecosystem of entrepreneurial startups. And then, again, to fill in the gaps, usually the gap is going to be very, very early stage deals, smaller stage deals. VC funding in the U.S. has increased over the last 15 years, but by double, as a matter of fact, but only half but the amount going to zero and first stage investments has fallen by 50%, just because it's easier to make money on later and bigger deals. So I think there is a role for government to either directly or through partnerships to identify some of these smaller and earlier stage deals.
What are the best models for e-government infrastructure, e-finance infrastructure, e-health infrastructure, e-business, and internet infrastructure?
Well, I guess on the last one, I'm not sure what internet infrastructure is. If it's sort of, on the one hand, we have an internet infrastructure that is related to all the standards bodies within the internet and the various protocols, and that seems to be working very, very well. I think one of the biggest threats to it actually is the potential of an emerging takeover by the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, where they are wanting to develop a global, sort of very top-down, government-directed approach to managing global internet and exchange interactions. I think it's a very, very bad idea, a very risky idea. I think the sort of more informal, ad hoc nature of internet governance actually works pretty well. With regard to e-health, I think I alluded to that earlier. I think the real key there is that e-health is a chicken or egg issue. Doctors may not adopt something if the labs don't adopt it, if the hospitals don't adopt it, patients won't adopt it, et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, it's also one of those things with big externalities. The benefits from a doctor adopting an e-health system within their office, though a lot of those benefits flow to other users. They'll flow to the lab, or they'll flow to the other doctors who are using it, et cetera, et cetera. So they don't capture all the benefits. It's kind of like when the first person put in place a fax machine, bought a fax machine, actually, I guess those were corporations who were faxing to themselves, but every time anybody bought another fax machine, because of Metcalfe's law of the increasing value of networks, they were adding to the value of the network because they were another node in the fax system. And it's similar in healthcare. So you can't just rely on the government, on the market itself, on individual self-interested health providers wanting to do this. You need some real carrots and sticks and other kinds of policies like that. With regard to e-government, I really think there it's the real solution to e-government, at least in a lot of countries, at least certainly in the U.S., fundamentally has got to be that government moves to a different model. They move to what I would call the Tom Sawyer model, which is to, in other words, get other people to paint the fence. If you look at one model we have in the U.S., which is actually pretty successful, and that's tax. You compare the U.S. versus the British experience with tax. The British government, I guess it's the Exchequer there, does their taxes. I could be wrong. But they develop their own tax software system, and it had very, very serious problems. The systems would go down. There were security problems with them. It really didn't work very well. And then you compare that to the U.S., where we essentially opened up their system, if you will. They let app developers, companies like H&R Block or TurboTax or a lot of these other companies now, just develop tax software solutions and then integrate them into the back end so they can file directly there. And you've seen a lot of innovation in terms of tax software preparation. And I think that could be a model for government. Governments have a really, really, really hard time focusing on the needs of citizens. They largely get stuck by focusing on the needs of themselves, the needs of their own bureaucracy or division or department or program. And as much as governments talk about, we need joined up government or customer centric government, it's pretty hard to do. And I think if you enable these private sector providers, they could be for profit, they could be nonprofit, who are essentially integrators, if you will, thinking about the customer first, that's maybe a better model, at least for certain things in e-government.
From a broader perspective, how much of global GDP is driven by A, ICT, and B, the internet, and why?
Well, if you think about it's a series of concentric circles, and one of the smallest ones, although certainly huge, it's still compared to all, it would be just the .com internet. So the part of the internet that is just related to the .com domain name. We released a study a couple of years ago when it was the 25th anniversary of the first .com domain name being released, which was a company called Symbolics.com, where we estimated how much annual GDP increase is coming from the dot-com system. And there we weren't measuring how much, we weren't even measuring sort of, you know, how many jobs or output in the dot-com industry itself, which is significant. We were measuring how much the dot-com system enables productivity and innovation and growth. And we estimated it was $1.5 trillion a year, larger GDP, bigger than the biotechnology, energy industry, and one other industry, I can't remember now, bigger than all three of those combined. So it's a pretty, just the dot-com portion is pretty significant in terms of the efficiencies and productivity gains you get from, you know, e-commerce over through dot-com. But obviously you've got a lot more than that. So you've got all the rest of the internet, and then you also have just ICT in general. So, you know, a really good example of that is if you look at the rise of self-service technologies. So when you go to an airport now, obviously a lot of people don't bother to stand in line and wait for this person to take their information and type it into a computer and have the computer print something out. They just go to a computer themselves and stick in their credit card, and the computer does it all automatically. And the computer, in this case, is a kiosk. So that's the reason kiosks are so good these days and so versatile and so accurate is because largely because of advances in ICT, the hardware, the software, the connectivity. So we're seeing this big explosion around the world in self-service technologies like kiosks, and they add a lot of by improving productivity and efficiency, they're adding a lot to GDP as well. And then just, you know, other things like that, other simple things, if you will. I recently visited a company in San Diego called Life Technology, and they're a pretty interesting company that is a they make genetic sequencing machine. They make machines that are actually now, they have a new one coming out in about 18 months. It's very small. It's about the size of a big desktop computer kind of thing. And it will decode your entire genome from one person, decoded in, I'm gonna get this wrong, but certainly like a few hours, at a very, very low price. I think they were saying $1,000. But one of the reasons they can do that is because essentially your genome, I think it's around 4 terabytes of data, is how much your entire genome is, as you were to just put it into bits. And because of Moore's Law and improvement in processing power and storage, they can now do that on a desktop and do it very, very quickly. So that's going to be a huge savings to society as we can understand the genetic nature of diseases and do much better at diagnostics and other things. So I think when you really all put it together, in our view, and again, this is borne by a lot of economic studies, ICT is responsible for probably about half of all GDP growth, particularly in high-wage developed countries.
So what is the relationship between economic growth and ICT capacity availability today and into the future?
Can you say a little more about that question?
You know, there's ICT usage and capacity, and is there some relationship between that usage and economic growth?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if a country wants to figure out a way to get its GDP to go up faster than, significantly faster than it otherwise would, the single best way, let's say over 10 years, the single best way is to figure out how to transform more of your economy, from paper, you know, face-to-face, voice, analog communications and processes to digital ones. Single easiest way to do it. And the reason is, if you think about how do economies grow? Economies grow really two ways. One is there are new things and new capabilities that come on the set that are just, you know, transformative. So wireless communications is one of those. The invention of automobiles, you know, 120 years ago was another one. But even more importantly is just the ability to raise, to do something and do it more efficiently. So where some process might have taken 10 hours to do, now it only takes 6 hours. And if you can figure out a way to, or even better, take 0 hours because it's been replaced by a machine. You know, a good example of that is there's recent studies done on in the legal industry where legal firms employ many, many people to review documents, document management. And now with software, they can do that in a fraction of the time, a fraction of the actual human hours involved, because machines can do it just so much better, so much cheaper. And that's really fundamentally what societies need to do, in my view. They need to think of themselves as a giant enterprise. You know, United States Corporation, or, you know, India Corporation, or Thailand Corporation. And just to be clear, I don't mean that the government should own enterprises. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, when you think about an entire economy, it's in an ecosystem with multiple organizations, and the role of government is to figure out a wide variety of things, in some cases not regulating privacy too hard, in other cases encouraging collaboration around healthcare, in other cases making sure there's digital literacy, in other cases the areas where they're providing services directly to do them efficiently. But the goal is to really figure out a way to get as many organizations in your economy to use digital technologies to do things faster, better, cheaper.
What do you see as the hottest topics in ICT for today and into the future?
Well, I think the hottest topics are things obviously like cloud computing and social networking, things like big data. So that's a really interesting emerging area where we now have much more capabilities to take very large data sets, sometimes in real time, and get intelligence out of them, get actionable meaning out of them, and learn things about them that we wouldn't be able to learn. A good example of that is in healthcare, where if you could take large data sets almost in real time of what's happening to a country's patient population, again, totally anonymized, you would learn an enormous amount about disease treatment and the way to do it most effectively, I should say, also the way to do it at the lowest cost. But that requires building an infrastructure for large data capture and analysis. Those things just don't happen by themselves.
Do you have some sense of how big the ICT sector is in trillions of dollars today, and maybe do some forecasting into the future?
Do I have a sense of how big it is? Is that what you said?
Yes, that's correct. In trillions of dollars. Is it like $10 trillion, do you think, out of the, you know, $70-plus trillion global economy, or $5 trillion, or...
You know, I don't know. I haven't looked at that. It's certainly not. I don't believe it's $10 trillion. But I think one of the things that countries need to look at is that there's both, when they think about ICT, there's certainly the ICT industry itself, so the jobs and enterprises in that industry, whether it's hardware, software, communications, applications, but then there are content, even then there are all of the economic activity of the users of ICT, and that's really, I think, where that's where the biggest impacts are, and the areas where I think a lot of times governments overlook that. They're looking just at the economic value of the ICT industry, the, if you will, the tool makers rather than the tool users.
You know, we have computing out there, a lot of computer professionals. I guess an estimated number is about 35 million worldwide, and there's an additional 50% that aren't even accounted for because their job titles are ingrained into other roles. And I guess there's a predicted something like 30% labor growth going into the future, perhaps in the next 5 years. So you have all of these millions of professionals. Do you see some kind of trend or need to, you know, have them become a recognized profession, like in medicine or law or accounting, where there's demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, perhaps recognized non-licensed credentials?
So we do a study every couple of years on our website. It's on our website, called the State New Economy Index, and one of the things we measure U.S. states on is the amount of ICT workers that they have in their states that are not in the ICT industry. We measure that on another indicator we have. But this one just says, how many ICT workers do you have outside of the hardware and software industry? And it turns out that's, as you rightly noted, that's where the lion's share of ICT workers are. They're in the healthcare industry, or the logistics industry, or the financial services industry, or wherever. And oftentimes they're not really recognized at that. There's a nice study by Lauren Hitt, who's at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and he found that ICT workers, regardless of what industry they were in, actually contributed significantly more value than any other occupation, compared to their compared to their wages, if you will. So I think there is more that could be done with regard to occupational, with regard to certifications and other things like that. And certainly, you know, companies like Cisco are doing some of that, and other companies, Microsoft and others.
Now, this is a bit of an open-ended question, and that is, you know, we discussed a lot of areas in terms of policy, innovation, and so on, and some of the trends that are out there. If you were conducting this interview, what kinds of questions should I have asked you, and then what would be the answers?
I think you asked very, very good and detailed questions. I think that perhaps one might have been sort of you know, who's sort of in the lead and why, and there I think it's a you know, it's just a variety of different. And I think what we see around the world is that each, certainly not each country, but some countries are leading in certain areas. Like the Japanese are leading in broadband, and the Koreans are leading in, you know, what are, you know, smart cities, and the Finns are leading in healthcare, and the Canadians and the Singaporeans are leading in e-government. The U.S. and Australia are leading in enterprise use. So I think that really one because of that diversity, if you will, that global diversity, it's not as if one country is leading in every area. There's a real opportunity to learn from other countries what the best models are, and how we can all, as, you know, different countries, all figure out how to get better in terms of our own digital economy ecosystem.
So you mentioned some of the areas in which countries are leading there. You gave some specific examples, and kind of as an addendum to that, what are the best resources to get this information, additional information?
We have a lot of that on our website, which is itif.org, and if you just go to the website, you can look under wireless or look under digital economy or other, and there's a lot of studies. We've just done one you may have mentioned earlier called the Global Innovation Policy Index. It ranks countries on a wide variety of indicators, including digital economy factors. So that's one good source to look at. And the OECD is another source.
Well, the interesting thing is I know that in your research, you look at World Bank figures, the OECD, and many other institutions out there, and the data that they're producing, and you're kind of aggregating, sifting through it, filtering it, and providing sort of very meaningful sort of predictions from that data. So I think your site is probably the best to go to.
Great.
Well, Robert, I know that you have to run. So again, thank you for coming in today to do this interview. You have an amazing background, a great history in terms of innovation and policy. And I know that it was hard to get you in because you are so in wide demand. So again, thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Great. It was really my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Robert Atkinson, founding president, ITIF, internationally acclaimed leader in technology, innovation, and policy.